Oh, about time. I've been asking for a more autobiographical musical theme for just ever since we started the show, and finally we got it. I'm Too Sexy. Right, said Fred. And it's relevant to the topic we're going to discuss in the minefield today, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. What does that song have to do with morality, you ask? Well, good question. But I suppose today, Scott... Oh, we'll lead Ali here. Scott Stevens there. I suppose today, Scott, we're looking at ethics in fashion, but then also ethics as fashion. And I think that kind of encapsulates one of the great conundrums of the modern condition, would you say?
It does indeed. Look, I do think, by the way, that if the ABC is foolish enough to renew our show again next year, we change it to the catwalk. What do you think? The catwalk.
That's a great
on RN.
Idea.
I know.
I would love to hear a promo that says the catwalk on RN.
That's yes. But look, you know, I mean, there is actually a reason, you know, all jokes notwithstanding, there is a reason why this show is called The Minefield. You know, there is something about the sheer complexity of modern life. And I think that complexity itself has to be theorized. We have to consider why it is that our world seems as morally complex as it is. You can't consume anything without having to think at some stage or another, or at least choose to be willfully ignorant, about the effect that that consumption is going to have on the producer. You have to think before you buy whatever clothes you want to wear. You have to think before you adopt certain forms of transport. Everything about modern life, it seems, is potentially a ticking time bomb. It's a minefield. And one of the real challenges, I think, for our show, Waleed, is that how do you help people to think about those hidden dilemmas in modern life? How do you get people to be more aware about what they're doing and about the consequences of what they do on the lives of others without that creating an entire generation of paranoid conspiratorial cynics? This is an immensely complicated topic, and the very fact that something as seemingly simple and straightforward as the clothes that we buy and wear, our fashion choices, could be as morally complex as they are, I think that's something that really ought to give us serious pause.
So what you're effectively arguing, if I've got you right, Scott, is that the interrelationships between people that are sort of drenched in all sorts of dynamics, including dynamics of exploitation, are now unavoidable. Or are they, I suppose, becomes a question.
That's the question.
But let's say you're saying they're hard to avoid, right? Let's put it that way. Because our lives are so enmeshed in a global market, effectively, that trades on that exploitation. So that even benign, utterly benign consumer choices that we make become morally loaded. And then it becomes a question of, well, to what extent do we pay attention to that impossibly intricate terrain? And if we do pay attention to it, what are our moral responsibilities? And does it all become too difficult, so difficult, that actually we end up just saying, you know, forget it. I'm just not even going to think morally about this. I like where you're going. I think it's a very rich area to explore. And so I don't want to undermine that, Scott. But here's my question to you. Is there anything really new in that kind of interdependency, in that kind of intricacy, that moral difficulty? Because if I think about a pre-modern environment, for example, surely the things that we owned, whether it be private property or it be wealth in whatever form, jewelry or gold or whatever it might be, or, you know, land, whatever, there were implicated within that all kinds of political dynamics that had moral dimensions to them. So in an age of empire, for example, there's every chance that your well-being was funded by some kind of conquest in which people were wronged. I wonder if this is just something that is an inherent part of the human condition. Once there is interdependency, or once the human being has the capacity to harm another human being for their own gain, and then we build power structures that mean that other people can benefit from that wrongdoing, haven't we always been in this predicament? And then isn't the only real difference, perhaps, either that some people care a little bit more about that stuff now than perhaps they did in the past, or we don't quite have a legitimizing narrative that means we can kind of just theorize away the moral complexity, or there's just more information flow now?
Look, I think that's a fabulous series of questions. I don't think that the extent to which pre-modern forms of life were themselves complicit in certain forms of exploitation and conquest, I don't think that can be washed away. And I certainly don't think that we should be ignoring that, or, you know, looking back to the good old days of mercantile trade and artisanship at the local village level with any kind of, you know, rosy glasses. But I do think, Waleed, there are two differences in the modern time. One is value. value itself was something that was far more socially measured than it is at the moment. In other words, value isn't just, geez, that's good value for money, or wow, I can't believe how cheap that shirt is. Value is also the extent to which my purchasing this honors the hard work or honors the craftsmanship that has gone into producing it in the first place. That was something that could be more immediately judged and then more immediately honored by means of the act of purchase. In other words,
so you're saying this is all pre-industrial revolution, I presume, because once industrial revolution happens, that changes radically.
Yeah, it does and it doesn't. I mean, this is actually one of the myths that's often told, though, about the industrial revolution, is, you know, everything didn't simply go straight to being factories, or when once things did go to factories, everything didn't suddenly get hidden behind a wall of consumption goods. I mean, this is one of the great arguments, for instance, of the early union movements, that it was so important to restore workmanly value, to restore a deeper sense of value, not simply measured by quantity and productivity, to the objects themselves. Once workers themselves are able to organize and are able to take a degree of both control over and ownership of what they're producing, I mean, geez, you know, you brought out my inner Marx in me, Willie.
I can't even believe it. We get into rapidly Marxist terrain here.
But
the point you're trying to make,
I think this is actually very, very important, that there were ways, if you like, of honoring, of regarding, and investing value into consumer objects that we simply cannot have access to today because the rationale, the logic of value, has been washed away by the sheer market mechanism of as much as possible and as cheaply as possible.
It's interesting, though, when you're talking on behalf of the unions there, you use the word restore.
Yeah.
And that says to me that something was lost. And effectively, again, at the risk of invoking a kind of Marxist resonance, what we're talking about is the alienation of value from labour.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So if I make some kind of artifact and it takes me a week to make, there's something intrinsic about that, and then I sell it directly. That's a very simple thing where the labour is embodied in the artifact and the price, and it's obvious what's going on. The minute it comes out of some kind of alienated, mass-produced thing, then we don't see the labour in the same way. In kind of the same way as when we buy meat from a supermarket, we don't see the animal because of the shrink wrapping and all of that sort of stuff. So maybe what we're trying to get to then, Scott, is not so much the idea of the fact that there are moral layers and moral complicities in the way we live our lives, but that in some ways what the mass production of things and the dominance of the market has done is meant that those things have become far more invisible to us.
Exactly.
Right, so they're just kind of coded in a way that makes them ordinary.
But this then raises the really interesting thing for me. When the processes of production, when the very notion of labor value has been emptied, if you like, or has been hidden behind mass production, then it means if we do want to buy something that is differentiated, if we do want to buy a product that isn't just mass-produced or that is of a higher quote-unquote value, then how do we judge that? On the one hand, we've got labels. You know, the thing that first comes to mind are fashion labels. But do you notice that as, and this is really due to a bunch of very active, very vocal NGOs, this is due to our growing awareness of globalization, this is due to a good number of very fine public philosophers and public intellectuals pointing great big fingers saying you can't ignore this any longer, we've seen an explosion over the last decade of what can only be called ethical labels. So when you buy this coffee, this is fair trade coffee. When you buy this chocolate, this is done under certain conditions. When you buy this clothing, this has been done under conditions that aren't on the basis of exploitation or even slave labor. In other words, ethics itself has become a matter of appearance. Ethics itself becomes a kind of, potentially at least, fashion statement. And that is something seriously new.
Okay, there's something there I want to pick up. But before that, I wonder what flows from that. Can ethics itself become commodified? So can you not just turn ethics into a fashion, the idea of performing ethics, which is the thing I've been interested in for a very long time, but the thing that I'm interested in right now, can you buy it? Can you buy a way out of your moral complicity? And in this regard, I know you know this very well, because you introduced it to me, a wonderful satirical piece that is making precisely this sort of argument by Thomas Wells that I think you might have actually published.
I did indeed.
Yourself. Just very quickly, take us through the premise of that.
It's fabulous. We'll put a link on the Mindfield website. I dare people not to think that this is the future of ethics. What Thomas Wells suggests is that in a massively morally complex world where everything we buy is sort of ethically loaded, the future is going to be, how do we buy good, clean, ethical consciences for ourselves? And what he suggests is that some company, sometime in the future, needs to invent moral offsets. In other words, you pay for a low, low price of $19.95 a month. You buy, if you like, you outsource your ethical responsibilities to another company who will make donations, who will target certain worthy NGOs, who will target certain worthy global causes on your behalf, so that as you, you know, the best that you can try to be a good global citizen going about your everyday life, this other company, it's kind of like modern forms of indulgences, will buy you your get out of bad conscience free card.
So wear whatever brand you like, but pay this company money to wash your conscience. It's a carbon offset
morality. For morality, that's right.
Now, what's amazing is this is a piece of satire. I'm sure there will be people who would hear this, or maybe they're not the kind of people who would listen to us, but who will go, this is a great business idea, and proceed, right? And so what that's evoking is a sense that we can commodify ethics itself, right? But then the reason that that's possible is this incredible, almost infinite moral complexity that we've sort of roughly sketched. My question then becomes, Scott, and maybe this is the hard edge of it, what is actually the obligation on the individual in that case? Mm. If we all accept that, you know what, it's actually just too hard. It's too complicated. It is too unwieldy to live a thoroughly moral life in a world where the immorality of things is just embedded in things we must use every single day. If you must be touched by the smoke of this stuff, no matter what, then does there come a point where the individual is actually entitled to say, you know what, I'm not even trying?
Yeah, look, that I'll confess to you, Willie, that's a question that I wrestle with every day. I think what is largely inexcusable is moral inattentiveness. In other words, just deciding it's just not worth it. I just have to switch off for peace of mind. I think one of the things, though, that really screws us constantly is the fact that modern life operates at such a pace with so many colors in its spectrum, with so little time given for careful deliberation and for patient thinking. We have to, you know, it's almost like there's a ticking clock always over our shoulder. I think one of the difficult things is the sheer pace and sheer visual complexity of modern life wars against the time that we need to take in order to live ethically defensibly. Mm. Now, I don't think there's ever an excuse for moral inattentiveness. What I think there is an excuse for, though, is doing our best in the meantime to so simplify our lives and so curtail unnecessary habits that we do have the opportunity to try to think and act a bit more deliberatively, a bit more carefully than we already do. And look, I should also say that part of the problem of a globalized world is that we oftentimes end up caring far more about people further away from us. I'm not saying that that's a sphere of concern we should cut off, but I think that one of the side effects of a simpler, more patient life is greater attentiveness to those immediately around us.
It's an interesting thought. We don't have time really to think it through, Scott. Got to get on with things. You are listening to The Mindfield. You can leave a comment on our website by searching for RN The Mindfield. You can also tweet us at RN The Mindfield.
It looked like the aftermath of a massive earthquake. The 8-story building collapsing in an instant. Scores of people were buried in what's become a coffin of concrete and metal. My husband is inside there, this woman cries, not knowing where to look. The building housed several clothing factories. Workers had complained the building was unsafe after cracks appeared, but they say local managers ordered them back in just an hour before the collapse.
It's the shocking reality of the behind the clothes that so many of us buy and wear. That, of course, was April 2013 when a Bangladeshi building, the Rana Plaza, housing many garment factories, collapsed. It was Bangladesh's worst industrial accident, but it was also a kind of symbolic event that galvanized an entire movement, a whole new consciousness about the ethical consequences of the clothes that we buy. Someone, thankfully, who's actually done quite a lot of work on this, who is really a wonderfully original thinker, though, about some of the moral complexities that this raises, is Lisa Hines. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Sydney, and she specializes in issues of sustainability in food, in fashion, and in travel. Lisa, I do just have to ask you, even before the Rana Plaza disaster, if I saw a label that said made in China, I knew that it wasn't being made in the best, most sustainable, most humane conditions. Just how important was the Rana Plaza disaster in, if you like, galvanizing some kind of global consciousness?
I think that what Rana Plaza did was, first of all, it was on such a scale that it was able to garner the international media's attention in a way that we hadn't really seen with ethical fashion for quite some time. But the other key thing that happened as a result of Rana Plaza was that we saw how many brands didn't actually know where their clothes were being made. So it was very common to find these labels floating in the detritus of this disaster, and the brands were there saying, no, no, we don't contract to that factory, we contract somewhere else. And so what it did was really highlight this pattern of subcontracting that is quite common in fashion, and it's one of the biggest problems in really uncovering where our clothes are in fact made.
That's the kind of moral inattentiveness that Scott's talking about, though, isn't it, Lisa?
Yeah, absolutely. And when a company is kind of allowed to say, no, we didn't know that was happening, well, why don't they know that it was happening? And it really starts to, again, take the attention off the consumer or the shopper, and you have to look a bit more closely at the industry itself to say, well, how have you let it get to this point?
So if you're talking to consumers, though, now, if the labels don't even know, how are the consumers meant to make any ethical decisions in this kind of area?
Yeah, it is, pun intended, it is a minefield for consumers out there. I couldn't help myself. There are a number of labels, as Scott mentioned earlier, in terms of fair trade and ethical fashion. And there's some really handy consumer tools. There's some apps and labeling systems out there for people who are interested in doing this. There's some incredible investigatory work happening in terms of really uncovering which industry labels are doing their homework and which aren't. But it can be quite difficult as a consumer to make that right decision.
Yeah. You see, this though, talking of minefields, this is one of the great problems in a globalized world. One of the myths, I think, that we were telling ourselves for quite some time, and sociologists kind of long kept these myths going, is that if you just arm people with enough knowledge, then they would actually make ethically informed or rational decisions. I mean, one of the things that some of your research has been pointing out that just resonates so deeply with other areas is that once people know that these garments are being made in highly problematic places, the more NGOs tell people what these problems are, it's actually creating this gap between what people actually know and the consumption habits that many times keep going in defiance of the very NGOs that are trying to point out the ethical problems with what people buy.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I wholeheartedly support the work of the NGOs for doing what they're doing. But what ends up happening is that we, as humans, when we are told things that have this negative implication, saying things to us like, don't buy this because it's bad for these reasons, and you're basically supporting sweatshops, what that does for us as individuals is make us feel bad about ourselves because we have been buying in this way already. So we start to tune out these really important messages because it actually makes us feel really bad about ourselves, and then therefore we just block out these messages, and it's what's called willful ignorance. We know that there are these problems out there, but when you come right down to it, it's also overwhelming, and it makes us feel bad because we can't always do the right thing, and so then we end up not doing anything.
That sounds like a form of, like a coping mechanism, though. And if that's what it is, how morally blameworthy can we say that is?
Yeah, it is somewhat of a coping mechanism. And I think to some of the points you were making earlier, in modern time, we have less time to delve into these issues on a really deep level. But at the same time, there's opportunities for us to talk about ethics and fashion in a different way that kind of takes the weight off of all the negative messaging and maybe focuses on some of the more positive and uplifting stories. Because at the end of the day, if this is what's going to encourage us as human beings to act in a certain way, perhaps we need to kind of flip the conversation and focus on you know, some of these more positive aspects of the fashion industry and the changes that are being made.
Okay, so let's flip that. Let's talk about those people that actually have made conscientious, deliberate decisions to source ethically manufactured food, clothes.
Well, food's the same issue, isn't it?
It is. It is exactly the same issue. One of the things that Waleed and I have long been interested in is when ethics itself becomes a kind of performance. This is actually a very old idea. I mean, it goes back to Rousseau and others, that ethics is something you put on first, and then slowly but surely that form of behavior works its way onto the inside. I mean, when ethics, especially with fashion, ethics is something that becomes very, very visible. You can actually see people, dare I say, who are choosing to wear ethical clothing. But again, is that always having the desired effect?
It can have the desired effect in certain instances. So it can have the desired effect if, for instance, the clothing that is being worn is kind of breaking those stereotypes of what ethical fashion used to look like. Because for better or worse, ethical fashion still has this stigma that it's ugly and unfashionable and people don't want to wear it. So when you have
mostly,
some of these...
Mostly muumuus and tights and daisies and things like that.
And scratchy, and scratchy hemp sack-like clothing. That's the first thing that comes to mind for most people. But that's really just not the case anymore. We're so far from that. And so if we can start kind of celebrating these brands that are making beautiful fashion, you know, in line with other fashion that's out there, if we can start focusing on that, then at least we're starting to shift that conversation away. And there's a number of things that brands are doing in terms of, you know, it's called radical transparency when they're really taking ownership of that supply chain and knowing, keeping track of every single step so that they and their consumers can feel good about what's being done.
But it's also about cost, isn't it? Like, so one of the reasons that atrocious labor conditions are exploited is because it's so much cheaper to produce the clothes that way. You get greater profit margins and you can keep the prices relatively low and still make a profit. I wonder if there's a bigger question we refuse to confront, really, which is that we still, while we're making all these ethical noises, are demanding cheaper stuff. And while we're tweeting about how angry we are about the fire in Bangladesh, for example, we're doing it on a phone that was probably manufactured in a sweatshop somewhere. And doesn't this actually require, which goes back to the question of, is this just all too difficult for us? Doesn't it require a real thoroughgoing reordering of the entire global economy, which none of us can really achieve?
Yeah, I mean, we can't reorder the entire global economy, at least not this year, anyway. But
you lack Malcolm Turnbull's optimism. I know.
But there's no doubt that there is a huge connection between the number of clothes that we buy and the price of clothes that we've gotten used to buying. The amount that we spend on clothes has continually gone down year after year. We don't value clothes in the same way as we did even 15, 20 years ago. There's been a huge change in the fashion industry in such a short period where we're just not valuing our clothes. And you're absolutely right that this is a huge area of concern.
Let me just ask you though, Lisa, just really, really quickly. Yeah. I mean, in the past, you take cheaply manufactured clothes, put a designer label on it, and then get some superstar to advertise it, and that sort of invested those clothes with magical value. What some companies are doing now is renouncing the usual circle of advertising, whatever, and actually making what you described before as radical transparency a new part of their marketing mechanism. I mean, is that cause for hope?
I think it's absolutely cause for hope. There's some really creative brands out there where you can, as a buyer, when you've purchased that article of clothing, you can click a link or a QR code and it shows you every single person who has worked on that garment. And I think this is, you know, you're not only de-alienating the labor from the product in that regard, you're truly connecting people with one another, but you're also just opening up at that realization of this is an actual real person who made this with real skills, and it does help you value that garment a little bit more.
Lisa, it's been wonderful to have access to your expertise today. Thank you so much for joining us in the Minefield.
Thanks for having me.
You got out of it safely too. It's amazing. Lisa Hines, PhD candidate at the University of Sydney. She specialises in issues of sustainability in everyday life, including, of course, fashion, but also food and travel. Scott, it's amazing. We end up in that situation where we go, well, the solution to this is really going to lie in an alternative form of branding.
Yeah.
And thus the logic completes itself. But maybe that's a topic for another day.
Yeah, but what it also probably does is it does tell us that there are very few aspects of modern life that can't be reconsidered ethically. Maybe ethics needs to be a bit more kind of robust than it has been in the past and a bit less Puritan.
Or at least rebranded.
Yeah, well, why not?
All right. Well, it's been wonderful to have your company today. That is it for The Minefield. If you'd like to get in touch with us on Twitter, you can do that. At RNTheMinefield is our handle. And it'd be wonderful to hear from you. At least Scott thinks so, because he'll be the one that's tending to all of those things. In the meantime, we'll see you next week. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Waleed. See you next week.
Well, there's science,
music,
mayhem and malarkey,
street life,
bush life,
food,
history,
philosophy,
politics,
funny stuff,
and enough's enough.
If you're curious about everything, so are we. RN Afternoons, 2 hours about everything, with me, Michael McKenzie, 1 till 3 weekdays, and online all the time, right here on RN.